Well, good morning, Bodhisattvas. It's so beautiful here. It's always beautiful at Loon Lake. I almost called it Green Lake because the color, the reflected color of the forest on the water is so vibrant in the sun. We are most fortunate to have this sun and the frosty mornings at Loon Lake this year, if anyone remembers last year. There were torrential rains, and we didn't even realize at first just how torrential they were. We just thought, oh, well, it's Loon Lake, it's raining. So really grateful for the sunlight. Oh, I forgot this. Dharma talks are getting complicated. Good thing there's still green tea. You know, there's that kind of gruesome story, about how Bodhidharma ripped off his eyelids because he was having trouble staying awake in his cave for 7 years. And he flung the eyelids out of the cave and two tea plants grew up from his eyelids. Terrible story. But we're grateful that tea came from India to China and to Japan and to us, because green tea is good medicine for Sesshin. At least for me. And speaking of good medicine, I guess it's timely that we are talking a lot about Vimalakirti's illness for this practice period, because we've been living in the pandemic, we still are, and the first year, at least in Canada, a lot of us didn't get sick. And we didn't even know that many people who were getting sick. The people I knew who were getting sick were in south of the border. And then the second year, more people got sick. And last year, we had Sesshin, and nobody got sick. But this year, people had to drop out more before they got here. And so far, so good while we're here. More people are getting sick, and not just with COVID, but with the colds and flus that we kind of avoided when we were all masked all the time. So a lot of us are one way or another experiencing the physical distress and the disruption of illness these days. Maybe some of you out there are among the ones who can't be with us. I hope you're feeling better. I hope you're staying warm and hydrated and resting lots. And we'll try and stay healthy here, take care of ourselves here. The core teaching of the Vimalakirti Sutra, right, is conveyed through this image of Vimalakirti's sick room, where he lies in bed surrounded by the... What's happening? Uh-oh. Oh, no, did I do that?
It's okay. I had to check.
I know why. I really checked. Okay, that was a little tech check on the recorder. Yeah, so there's Vimalakirti in his sick room, his 10 by 10 little sick room, surrounded by thousands and thousands of Buddha's disciples and bodhisattvas and all kinds of supernatural beings. And nobody has the courage to say, how are you doing? To speak up and say, how are you doing? They're all too intimidated because Vimalakirti has such a reputation for brilliant Dharma. And they've all been embarrassed by him in the past. Until finally Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, summons up the courage to pay a visit with the Buddha's encouragement and ask them with security. And the way he does it is the way we typically do, you know. How you doing? How long have you been sick? What are your symptoms? How's the treatment going? Right? That's what we ask. But Vimalakirti answers in a completely unexpected way. He says, "This illness of mine is born of ignorance and feelings of self-clinging. Because all living beings are ill, therefore I am ill. If living beings are relieved of illness, then my illness will be mended. Why? Because a bodhisattva, for the sake of living beings, enters the realm of birth and death. And being in the realm of birth and death, they suffer illness. If living beings can gain release from illness, then the bodhisattva will no longer be ill." So, of course, Vimalakirti is not just talking about physical illness, right? He's talking about dukkha, the pervasive sense of suffering and dissatisfaction that we generate in our lives when we don't get what we want or we get too much of what we don't want. When our worldview centers on ourself, up against everything and everyone else. Over and over and over in the sutra, Vimalakirti insists that to live as a bodhisattva in what's called the saha world, the world of suffering, we must not turn away from the suffering around and within us, from those parts of the world and ourselves that we would rather not deal with. Too painful, too frightening, too upsetting, too enraging. So today, I want to talk about pain and suffering. Right? Be a good Buddhist and talk about pain and suffering. How we can come near and not run away. To attend to and tend our own pain and others. Physical, emotional, spiritual. And we could add social, political, and environmental, because that all affects us too. Often in Buddhist teachings, there's a distinction made between pain and suffering, though in many respects, often we just use them synonymously. The 20th century Indian guru Nisargadatta, who was known for his teachings on non-duality, wasn't a Buddhist. He was Hindu, but he taught non-duality, and he said this: pain is physical, suffering is mental. Suffering is due entirely to clinging or resisting. It is a sign of our unwillingness to move, to flow with life. Although all life has pain, a wise life is free of suffering. A wise person is friendly with the inevitable and does not suffer. Pain they know, but it does not break them. If they can, they do what is possible to restore balance. And if not, they let things take their course. This, of course, is the first noble truth taught by the Buddha. There is suffering in our lives on this earth. And the second, the cause of suffering, is our clinging and aversion. And the third, there is cessation or freedom from suffering. And the fourth, that there is a path to the cessation of suffering, which is the noble eightfold path, symbolized by the eight-spoked Dharma wheel. Right mindfulness and right concentration are the two of the spokes that are primarily concerned with meditation. We need both. We need right mindfulness and right concentration in good balance. But I think many Zen practitioners tend to forget or neglect the other spokes and think that meditation is it, the solution to our misery. We tend to forget how synergistically these eight spokes on the wheel function to free us from our dukkha-generating habit patterns. So right view and right intention orient our mind and our heart towards the teachings and practices of the Dharma. Right conduct, right speech, and right livelihood support a life with enough stability to even practice. Because if your life is completely disordered in terms of speech, conduct, and livelihood, it's pretty hard to practice. And right energy, or right effort not too tight, not too slack, that pervades every, not only our zazen, but every aspect of our life. So, with all that in mind, here we are in Sesshin, sitting for hours on end. So let's look at the pain that arises in zazen. Does anybody have painful knees? Back? Hips? Neck? Head? Stomach, maybe? Right? We bring the tensions and aches and pains from our daily lives to Sesshin. And often those, you know, particularly the first couple of days, those really are prominent. And they can assail us in alarming ways. How can just sitting doing nothing be so painful? No pain, no gain? Who said that? Is it true? Is it true in Zen practice? Wikipedia tells me that Jane Fonda was at least partly responsible for promoting no pain, no gain in her TV workouts in the early 80s. Based on the belief that working out past the point of muscle pain produces best results. This concept has been debunked by research, but it is still persistent, and probably it's still persistent because it has deeper roots. Wikipedia also provides me, this is, who would have ever thought? Not so long ago that I would be sourcing from Wikipedia for Dharma Talk, but a quote from a fellow named, a scholar named David B. Morris, whose work focuses on pain, illness, and culture. Very interesting territory. And he wrote in The Scientist, "No Pain, No Gain is an American modern mini-narrative. It compresses the story of a protagonist who understands that the road to achievement runs only through hardship." A very persistent cultural myth, meme, whatever we want to call it, right? No pain, no gain. And the message goes back to the ancient Greeks, Sophocles in the 5th century before the Common Era in the play Electra wrote, depending on the translation, "Nothing truly succeeds without pain. Nothing succeeds without toil. There is no success without hard work." Different translations. "Without labor, nothing prospers." And Benjamin Franklin, the 18th century American statesman and political philosopher, wrote, "In the way to wealth, there are no gains without pains." So reading all this, I thought, now wait a minute. Isn't there a difference between hardship and hard work? Is hard work necessarily painful? Is it necessarily hardship? Isn't there satisfaction in the full engagement with hard work? So and as Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind tells us, we should practice without a gaining idea how much effort is enough, how much pain is too much. Well, there's no one-size-fits-all answer when it comes to our practice. It's true that for people who maybe are young and really fit, for whatever reasons, they can sit hours on end pain-free. But there may be other sources of anguish, right? And if a person has no anguish whatsoever, they're not likely to end up here. They're often one of those heavenly realms from which, at some point, there's a vulnerability to falling into one of the other realms because they're unacquainted with hardship, unacquainted with suffering, And sooner or later, life, you know, slaps you down. Sooner or later. And then it can be a hard fall. So a certain amount of pain and suffering wakes us up. Researchers in the field of pain have learned that pain is nothing if not subjective and multivalent and multifactorial in its causes. In earlier times, in the world of medicine and science, pain was viewed as mechanical. A wound was inflicted on the body in some way, and a nerve impulse is conducted to the brain, which results in the perception of pain. And this view is still quite active in pain medicine today, but another perspective offers more nuanced views, informed by both neuroscience and psychology. So what accounts for the phantom pain experienced by amputees? You've heard of that, right? Where it's still, it's very, very painful. Feels like that leg or that hand is still there. What accounts for such subjective differences in the way individuals describe pain that might be expected to be the same? You know, same physiology, different experience, different description. I remember when I worked as a hospice counselor, there was a patient in the hospice, a very elderly woman who had been had a lifelong, decades-long career as a teacher, never married, just upright with such a sense of personal dignity that she would never admit to being in pain. So the nurses learned to say, "Oh, my dear, are you feeling any discomfort?" "Oh, yes, I feel a little discomfort in my hip." Or, you know, it would go like that. They could not ask her to rate her pain. She, you know, "No, I'm fine, thank you." Yeah, and they could, of course, also read her body language, her face. But even that, she had a pretty good mask. So what role do cultural values and beliefs around pain play in the way we experience it? You know, what were you taught about pain growing up? Did it get you care and nurturance, or did it get you judgment and shame? Did you learn to not let anybody know when you were hurt? Since 1979, the International Pain Foundation has defined pain as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with actual or potential tissue damage. Well, you can also already see that that's limited, right? So only just 2 years ago, in 2020, they added these 6 points to that definition. Pain is always a personal experience that is influenced to varying degrees by biological, psychological, and social factors. Pain and nociception, so nociception is the what the neurons convey and are perceived. Pain cannot be inferred solely from the activity in sensory neurons. Through their life experiences, individuals learn the concept of pain, right? We can each reflect on that. What do we learn about pain, either physical or emotional? A person's report of an experience as pain should be respected. Did anybody ever brush aside your or deny your expressions of pain? Although pain usually serves an adaptive role, it may have adverse effects on function and social and psychological well-being. You know, so usually pain tells us there's something wrong that needs to be attended to. people who have a condition where they can't experience pain, even though the body's damaged, are really incapacitated in significant ways. They can't work. They can't, because they're constantly injuring themselves. And yet, hypersensitivity to pain is also incapacitating. Yeah. And verbal description is only one of several behaviors to express pain. Inability to communicate does not negate the possibility that a human or non-human animal experiences pain. This elusive quality of pain and that mechanistic model has led to views that pain that's unexpressed is not felt in the way, so that it was believed that animals didn't feel pain, or even that babies didn't feel pain in the way that we do, or that people who are in some way different, culturally, racially, or otherwise, don't feel pain in the same way we do. When I was thinking about this, I remembered over 30 years ago, 1990, my younger sister, who had moved to Japan after Michael and I had returned, she married a Japanese friend of ours. And a year later, she was diagnosed with an extremely aggressive lymphoma, the worst kind you can get. And I went over and I spent 5 of the 7-month course of her illness and her death and her funeral there in Japan with her. She never made it home. And I remember so much still, over 30 years later, vividly of that whole experience. But one moment that was a kind of revelation was when her husband said, "Oh, she doesn't feel pain like Japanese do." As though she were somehow impervious. At the same time, she was telling me, "I'm not very good at pain." What was going on? This light bulb went on in my mind that said, "Oh, all those racial and gender-based narratives about pain in our own, that our own culture has generated, that says they don't feel pain the way we do." And there it was. And that has resulted in so much unnecessary suffering and even cruelty in medical treatment. So currently, the basic guideline is, at least in the field of palliative care, pain is what the patient says it is. But it's still a slippery concept. Various metrics have been devised, scales and descriptors, to assess and quantify pain. The Irish writer, Sinead Gleason, who wrote this book called Constellations, is deeply acquainted with pain, having suffered a rare and severe type of childhood arthritis, a bout of leukemia in her early 20s, and a complicated pregnancy and childbirth in her 30s. I've been reading some pain narratives by women who I see as contemporary Vimalakirtis, because they're able to articulate their personal story of suffering in a way that's held in connection with larger social and political realities quite beautifully and compassionately. In one chapter of this book, it's called "Where Does It Hurt?" And she takes, it's subtitled 22 Stories Based on the McGill Pain Index. The McGill Pain Index was developed in 1971 as a method for assessing pain according to a scale. Doctors devised 77 words for pain, which are divided into 20 groups, and patients select a single word from each group, et cetera, et cetera. It is difficult to explain a specific pain to someone who has never experienced it, or to someone whose life has been largely devoid of pain. Medical practitioners created the list and chose the descriptors. The words do not come from the person experiencing the pain. The words belong to the doctor, not the sufferer. this is an attempt at reclamation. So she writes 22, they're really more like poems, and each one is titled with some of the descriptive words from the McGill Pain Index, like this one, pinching, pressing, gnawing, cramping, crushing. This one's called Unexplained Headaches. They recur, these infections, returning like sailors with the dawn from things they wish they'd never seen. There is a mouse in my skull, skittering within my cerebrum, gnawing at my cells. Where balance and posture are controlled, is it head or brain or tooth or jaw? I'm a bad archaeologist, like the ones in Indiana Jones, digging in the wrong places. Down that ear canal, pain spirals. Once I had vertigo and clung to a wall as though on a sinking ship. I swim between the hammer, anvil, stirrup, ossicles, oscillating. Those are parts of your ear, inner ear. I'll stop that there. I think I was, maybe I chose that excerpt. There's many other kinds in her chapter. Because my pain specialty is headaches, having experienced migraines since adolescence, though for years I had no idea what they even were. I am intrigued by cultural differences in how we experience pain and describe it and give it meaning. And I was delighted to learn that the Ainu, the indigenous people of Japan, experience bear headaches, deer headaches, and woodpecker headaches. I wrote a poem about migraines once, and mine was green gremlin, clawed green gremlin headaches. What kind of headaches do urban multitasking screen device addicts have? Another writer who speaks eloquently and politically about pain is the American poet and essayist Anne Boyer, who as a single working mother was diagnosed with, at the age of 41, with a highly aggressive form of breast cancer, requiring a double mastectomy and extremely harrowing course of chemotherapy, which took her to the edge of death. And she kind of counters that thinking about the inexpressibility of pain, maybe in words, but she says, a widely held notion about pain seems to be that it destroys language. But pain doesn't destroy language, it changes it. She says, the howls, cries, screams, shrieks, and whimpers of another in pain are unequivocal. The words, that hurts, that burns, aches. Various exclamations like, ow, ouch, expletive. How many of you swear when you pound your finger with a hammer or any of those other things we do, stub your toe? There was even a little clip on CBC saying that people who swear when they hurt themselves have more pain tolerance or something like that. Who did that research? Come on. A dog or a cat in pain is equally communicative. Maybe, sometimes not. Sometimes it's hard. That's why it's really hard to take care of a really aging animal, to do palliative care for your own pet, because they don't communicate as well. You have to do your best to read their pain. And maybe they do experience pain, but maybe they don't catastrophize it the way we do. You know, how long is this going to land? I don't know if I can take it until the bell rings. Can I make it through Sesshin if this keeps up? You know, they have a different way. And then she says, the drive to stop the pain of others because pain is so loud, so vividly expressed, often takes the form of wanting to do anything at all to end the pain of another, precisely because of the way this pain inflicts the experience of an impossible to bear sympathetic discomfort. Sometimes in the form of annoyance, sometimes in the form of anxiety, sometimes in the form of pity upon oneself, that discomfort. The drive to end the immediate pain of another creature in one's own proximity is so strong that it can sometimes compel the witness to pain to inflict greater pain upon the sufferer, as when adults threaten to give you something to cry about, right? You know, sometimes that incapacity to be present with another's pain is because that sympathetic resonance is so unbearable it has to be tamped down. So, as a long preamble to say, what about sitting with pain in zazen? Well, it depends, right? You have to listen carefully to what your own body mind is saying. You have to become acquainted with your own beliefs and reactions to pain, or even mild discomfort. So it's definitely worth staying with a feeling of discomfort when it arises in zazen in order to become better acquainted with it. Not to immediately react to that urge to squirm or scratch or twitch or relieve your restlessness or anxiety. Sometimes there can be a really compelling itch that if you just sit and breathe, completely vanishes. So where did that come from? Where did it go? So it's really worth noticing our emotional reactions to discomfort and pain, how we tense around it, and how to ground ourselves in our breath, maybe making a conscious, deliberate posture adjustment, or doing standing meditation for a while, or change our sitting gear, or with certain bodily challenges to learn how to do your zazen lying down. There are people, it's a good thing actually to learn how to do zazen lying down in case you're ever laid up with a broken limb and you're in the hospital or something, you know, you can still practice. It's good to not think, oh, if I can't sit in half lotus all upright and perfect, I can't do zazen. No one can know what your threshold of pain is, but you. Or when it becomes counterproductive to your practice, or damaging to your body. I'm not an advocate of gritted teeth Zen, although I have done my share. Or, you know, endurance for endurance's sake. There's a kind of cultural samurai ethic that the West adopted as part of the romance of Zen from Japan. And it doesn't really have much to do with what the Buddha taught, and much more to do with certain patriarchal, even militaristic traditions. And it can be too easy to conflate that with a kind of harsh and judgmental attitude towards the self and others. If we can't be present to our own pain, we'll have a hard time being present to that of others. And we may turn away from it or be overzealous in trying to overcome it in the way that Ann Boyer just described. Another hazard, I think, of taking sitting through pain to an extreme is dissociation. A Zen teacher once told me, oh, just imagine yourself out in space. Well, I'm not sure that's a good idea for people, for anyone who has, for whom dissociation has been a way to cope with physical, sexual, or emotional trauma. Maybe you're already too good at imagining yourself out in space. And maybe that doesn't help the true capacity we want to develop in our practice, to be present with our experience. Even though no one else can know your experience of pain, or you can't know anyone else's, it still can be good to just acknowledge your experience and check in with a teacher or someone more experienced once in a while for a little feedback and support. So this has been mostly about physical pain, but everything we're saying about physical pain goes for emotional, psychological, spiritual, existential pain, which are entwined. They're all very much entwined, right, in ways that we don't fully understand. So we need to, in our practice, bring some subtle awareness to those interconnections. You may have noticed yourself in your practice quite a bit of difference in your physical pain threshold depending on your emotional state, how tired or how well rested you are, all those other factors, right? And different emotional states have different physical manifestations. Remember that I gave you that quote from Nisargadatta who said, pain is physical, suffering is mental. I would like to take that further and say that pain is both physical and mental. Suffering is both physical and mental. Emotional pain is both physical and mental. I don't think that they're so neatly and tidily divided. Again, when I was working as a hospice counselor, over and over, people who were had suffered a deep loss, and they would tell me, I had no idea grief was such a physical experience. The heart palpitations, or the chest pain, or the nausea, or the insomnia, or the dizziness, even visual effects that people would report. And anxiety, as any of you know who have experienced anxiety, has its physical manifestations. Anger, shame, how do they feel in the body? All these states we'd rather avoid. And we have many, many ways in our daily life to distract ourselves and not attend to those states when they arise. But in Sesshin, we have the opportunity to stay with our experience. Uncomfortable as it may be, painful as it may be, to shine the light of awareness on our body and mind and attend with patience and with care. To find the middle path between the extremes of indulgence, I don't really like that word, but at the moment I can't think of another one, and a kind of self-punishing zeal on the other end. To find that middle path, to use right effort, not too slack, not too tight. And that point, that balance point, can change from day to day. It's not a set point. What makes the difference between the physical and mental pain inevitable in human life is that combination of wisdom or insight, compassion, and skillful means, applying all three. Darlene Cohen was a beloved Zen teacher at San Francisco Zen Center who suffered from rheumatoid arthritis, severe rheumatoid arthritis for decades. And she wrote a book called Finding a Joyful Life in the Heart of Pain. And then it was retitled in paperback as Turning Suffering Inside Out, a Zen Approach to Living with Physical and Emotional Pain. Very good book. In addition to offering many wise and practical teachings about practicing zazen when you are dealing with various kinds of pain. She emphasizes that when pain is a strong presence in our lives, we have to make a special effort to connect to what nourishes us and brings us joy. We have to make an extra effort to find joy. What grounds us, what connects us, what brings us joy? What are your deepest, most reliable sources of those things? Grounding, connection, joy. What are your deepest, most reliable sources? That's what you need to contact when pain is a strong presence. When I was growing up in childhood, the natural world was my most reliable and nourishing source. More so than the human world, and I still cannot help but feel joy and ease in the presence of hummingbirds, chickadees, waterfalls, rivers and creeks, mountains, mountain meadows. Through the pandemic, Michael and I would regularly just gotta go to a waterfall. We were blessed to live in the countryside, not far from here, so we have these particular waterfalls that we go to and breathe in the negative ions. Over the years, though, I have grown to appreciate the human joys much more. A smile exchanged with a stranger, a small gift given or received, a listening ear given or received, food prepared with love given or received. Suffering recedes, even when pain is still there. I perceive and hold it differently. Sense of humor helps as well. It's been years now, but I was coming home from work at night after it was when I was working for hospice, and it was dark and rainy, and I had got I'd had an evening event, and I got just a rapidly accelerating migraine, and it was before I knew that there's actually a drug that works. My single drug. And if anybody has ever had this kind of migraine where you have to barf. And I had to stop by the roadside trying to drive home twice. And I was just wretched. And then it was a weeknight on a country road, and a Mountie pulled me over for a, what do you call them? Drinking driving checks. And I just started laughing because the whole thing was so absurd, because I thought, he takes one look at me, he's gonna think I'm impaired, and I am. And so I just told him, I haven't been drinking, I just have a terrible headache, and I'm just trying to get home from work. And it was this sweet moment where, and it was kind of hilarious. You know, life is absurd sometimes. Anne Boyer describes how she and her friends enlivened, I like the word enlivened, made vivid, alive, her miserable experience of chemotherapy. She says, although it is true that I often felt lonely, it is also true that my friends had moved with me in shifts through the adventure of my illness, indulging my onco-surrealist fantasies of how to be sick, allowing me to wear my thrift store silk pajamas to the movies, helping me record images of hospital vacuum cleaners and the sounds of IV drips, joining me in throwing the celebratory cake at the end of chemotherapy rather than doing as is custom and eating it. We all agreed that if I had to have cancer, it should be experienced in a confetti storm of amor fati. Do you know that expression, amor fati? Love of fate. Love of one's fate. Has Greek and Latin roots, but it's most associated with the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, I want to learn more and more to see as beautiful what is necessary in things, then I shall be one of those who makes things beautiful. Amor Fati, let that be my love henceforth. I do not want to wage war against what is ugly. I do not want to accuse. I do not even want to accuse those who accuse. Looking away shall be my only negation. And all in all, and on the whole, someday I wish to be only a yes-sayer. And by that he means saying yes, meeting whatever comes with a yes. He means radical acceptance. Now, I'm no scholar of Nietzsche, and I won't attempt to go into some of the problematic aspects of his work. But it seems to me that he was reaching for something very close to the Bodhisattva path, which embraces the totality and the minutia of our human lives with, I'll say it again, wisdom, compassion, and skillful means. So this combination offers a dynamic radical acceptance, because the skillful means is the response. As human beings, we want to give meaning to our pain and suffering, right? The Christian story is that pain was born of our human original sin, and that as Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden, Adam stepped on a thorn. Ouch, the first ouch. Pain is punishment. And women got an even greater punishment, condemned to endure painful childbirth forever after. Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, writer, and Nobel Prize winner, wrote, "Suffering confers neither privileges nor rights. It all depends on how one uses it. If you use it to increase the anguish of others, you are degrading, even betraying it. And yet the day will come when we shall understand that suffering can elevate human beings. God help us to bear our suffering well." Now, I want to be really clear that I'm not offering a Buddhist version of the platitude, "God only gives us what we can handle." Because some people do get more suffering than they can handle in life, and some people do go under. And for reasons that do not reduce down to their past sins or their personal karma. There are lots of reasons why people go under and get too much suffering in this life. The biblical source of that Christian assertion goes like this: God is faithful, and he will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with your testing, he will also provide the way out so that you may be able to endure it. So if we think in Buddhist terms, what we are offered is not a creed or a belief system, but a scaffolding of practice that supports our capacity to be awake and alive in this world. So that we might say, as Vimalakirti did, "My illness arises from great compassion." Those of you who have followed along as we've studied this sutra may remember the passage where Vimalakirti lists all the ways a bodhisattva living as an ordinary person in this world can experience all the many states that we might typically view with dismay or aversion. Our greed, our desire, our anger, our laziness, our stupidity, our stinginess, all the ways we blunder and break the precepts, and yet have the capacity to regulate mind and body and not do harm. How we can experience pain and painful states, aversive states, and yet bring awareness and not do harm. And ultimately, we can face sickness, old age, and death and let go with grace when our time comes to let go. All these states are Dharma gates to open our hearts to the suffering of other beings and to find the skillful means to respond. Can you love your karmic life just as it is, in all its particularity and interconnectedness? Amor karma. Amor karma. The anthropologist, American anthropologist Richard Nelson, lived very closely with the Koyukon indigenous people of Alaska. And he wrote in his book, The Island Within, "Sometimes I wonder if I'll ever hear or see anything as it truly is, or if a lifetime is only enough to begin learning how to watch and listen. Science is a wonderful tool for examining, measuring, and describing the world, but its explanations are sometimes no more convincing and far less wise than the ancient stories of the mystical imagination. Perhaps certain things about the world are best discovered by engaging the senses completely and leaving the analytical mind at rest." So let's leave our analytical minds at rest during Sesshin. Of course, they'll start cranking up, but maybe we'll notice them and say, oh, you can rest, you can rest. We've been soaking up the ancient stories of the mystical imagination from the Vimalakirti Sutra with their imagery and vivid characters. Now let's see how they permeate our moment-to-moment experience right here, body and mind, in the daily rhythms of Sesshin, the lake, the light, the weather, receiving whatever arises and passes, just as it is, with open hearts and hands. So thank you, everyone, for your kind attention. Thank you, folks in the Zoom realm, for joining us. How marvelous. Let's chant together.